Have you ever felt that some Bible studies are too much? You know, they're too long, they're too deep, they're too serious, they're too theological, and yeah, maybe they're too boring. Well, we're going to try to remedy that with this podcast, the Where's God? Finding Him in the Small Stuff Bible Study. We're going to take a close look at Scripture. We're going to look at the cellular base of what God was saying through His Word. But we're not going to make it too much of anything. We're going to try to make it just right for everything. When Peter denied Jesus, it had a great impact on his life, obviously. And what we're going to talk about in this episode of Where's God? Finding Him in the Small Stuff Bible Study is both the act of Peter's denial and the aftermath of Peter's denial. The act. What did he do? How did he do it? What happened in that moment? And then we're going to take a look at the aftermath of his denial. What effect did this have on Peter? And the bigger question might be, did Peter learn his lesson? Did he learn his lesson? That's what we're going to talk about in this episode. Okay, so if you remember last week, we started on Peter's denial, and I mentioned that there were two phases of this, basically, that we wanted to look at. And the first phase was the prediction of Peter's denial, which is where, as we talked about last week, where Jesus predicts that Peter is going to deny him, and the word that Jesus uses is disown him. And in phase one, that is also where Peter where we have Peter's denial of the denial. So we have Jesus' prediction of the denial that you're going to disown me, and then we have Peter's denial of the denial. I will never, ever do that. Not ever, ever, never. And in that first phase, in Matthew 26 last week, we read where Jesus said, as they were walking, if you recall, they'd left the upper room from that Passover Last Supper meal, and they're on the way to the Garden of Gethsemane, where Jesus will be arrested. And this conversation all takes place as they're walking the streets of Jerusalem from one place to the other. And Jesus says that you will all, this night, tonight, you will all fall away from me and be scattered. And the Greek word used there for fall away, I don't remember if we said this last week or not, but the Greek word used for fall away there in the original Greek has the idea of to stumble. So what Jesus was saying is that because of me, this very night, I will cause you to stumble and fall away. And we see that in other places in the Bible where Jesus is prophesied as being to many a stumbling block, right? And so this is Jesus just basically reinforcing that. And he's saying, even to you, my closest disciples and followers, this very night, because of me, you will stumble and fall away and be scattered. And then we have in that first phase, Peter's I'm nots, right? Peter's I'm nots. Peter says, I'm not going to betray you, which Jesus had predicted during the Last Supper. I'm not going to fall away from you. I'm not going to stumble because of you. I'm not going to be scattered. And then then later when Jesus says, you know, you're also going to disown me, Peter's like, I'm not going to disown you. And whereas Peter has all of these am nots in that phase one, He also has an I am. And his I am is, I am going to die with you. I am willing to die with you. And so Jesus responds to that and says, okay, Peter, let's just see. And he says to Peter, you know, not only are you going to fall away from me and be scattered like all of the other disciples, you will all do this, but not only will you personally fall away and be scattered, but you will disown me. And you will not only do that once tonight or twice tonight, you will do that three times this very night before the rooster crows, which we said last week could have been as early as 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, possibly. I mean, I used to always think that roosters only crowed when the day broke. You know, it's daylight, the sun comes up and they start crowing. But as I mentioned, Jan and I found out watching a show about farmers that roosters can crow much earlier before the sun comes up. So anyway, and then in Matthew 26, at the very end, in Matthew 26, verse 56, in spite of Peter's protestations to the opposite, we find out that exactly what Jesus said would happen did happen. And Matthew records this in 26:56. He says, but this has all taken place, and this is Jesus speaking, but this has all taken place, and this is Jesus is saying this right as he's getting arrested at the Garden of Gethsemane. He says, but this has all taken place that the writings of the prophets might be fulfilled. And then Matthew adds in this little narrative point after that. Matthew writes, then all the disciples deserted him and fled. So exactly what Jesus said would happen is exactly what did happen. And that includes Peter, who said, I'm not going to fall away. I'm not going to be scattered. I am going to be willing to die with you. And here we have him running away too. So that brings us to phase two, which is phase two of Peter's denial is the act and the aftermath. So that's what we're going to launch into today. So turn, if you would, to Luke chapter 22. I'm going to start reading at verse 47 just to set the context of what we're going to be looking at. So Luke 22:47 says, while Jesus was still speaking, a crowd came up, and the man who was called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. He approached Jesus to kiss him, but Jesus asked him, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? When Jesus' followers saw what was going to happen, they said, Lord, should we strike with our swords? And one of them, that we know now is who? Peter. One of them, Peter, struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his right ear. Oh, Peter, Peter, Peter. But Jesus answered, no more of this. And he touched the man's ear and healed him. Then Jesus said to the chief priests, the officers of the temple guard, and the elders who had come for him, am I leading a rebellion that you have come with swords and clubs? Every day I was with you in the temple courts, and you did not lay a hand on me, but this is your hour when darkness reigns. So there we have Jesus' arrest in the garden and the response of Peter, who then, as we know from Matthew, once Jesus was arrested and bound, then kind of lost his nerve. The guy who struck the ear at that point, when he realized Jesus was being arrested, that Jesus was not going to intervene in a militaristic way. You know what I'm saying? What I mean to say, in a military way, in a way of Jesus' response was not going to be one of force. And he was not going to lead a rebellion, and he was not going to encourage them to fight here. And they actually did arrest him and take him off. Then that's when Peter lost his nerve and fled.
Then Jesus sort of encouraged him to mute.
Encouraged him to what? Right. I think at this point, whether Jesus encouraged them or not, I think there was probably enough common knowledge that Jesus was in danger from the religious leaders and different threats. I think there was just probably a feeling among the group that Jesus was in a risky position at this point in time. And so even if Jesus hadn't told them to gather swords or knives or whatever, I think they may have done that anyway, just because they themselves felt in danger, and they probably felt that Jesus was in danger, and they wanted to be ready in case they needed to do something to defend themselves and or him. So, right, it was more like a dagger or something. Right, it's more like a dagger or something like that, probably so.
I think so. What's happened?
That was his mindset at that time. He had just come through the washing of the feet, where he said, "Oh no, you got to wash my whole body, or you can't wash me at all." So he's very much into himself at that point. Then he also, when Jesus says, "You're going to die," he's, "I'm not going to do that." So at this point, Peter is very much into, I can handle this, you know. And so when this happened, you know, he thought, "I can handle this too." And out comes to say, you know, Peter's a he's a reacting kind of, he's a reactor. He reacts to things. And but you know, he do you think he was trying to cut off the guy's ear? He was trying to cut off his head, but the guy ducked. He was trying to cut off his head, the guy ducked, he got his ear instead. So this one I'll say okay.
The thing that always interests me so much about this passage is that Jesus touched his ear.
It's like nothing. Well, you wonder too, maybe how many people actually saw that, because it would have been dark. There would have been a lot of people around. How many people actually saw that happen? It's hard to say. But yeah, you're right. It's like another one of Jesus' miracles, all ho-hum, you know. It's kind of like going to the moon, right? It's cool the first few times, but then after that it becomes kind of, well, you know. I mean, I wouldn't think that if I saw Jesus' miracles, they'd all stand out to me, but I'm thinking maybe at the time they just didn't appreciate what he was doing. I don't know, some people. So anyway, we go to verse 54 then, and it says, then seizing him, they led him away and took him to the house of the high priest. Peter followed at a distance. Now, we know from other gospel writers that he was taken first to Annas, and Annas questioned him, and then he was taken to Caiaphas, and Caiaphas questioned him. Annas was, in the eyes of the Jewish people at the day, the real high priest. But Caiaphas had been installed as a high priest by the Romans. Yeah, I think it was he was a son-in-law or something like that. There was some relationship from a family standpoint, but I think he was a son-in-law. But Caiaphas was Annas' son-in-law. But so here, Luke isn't saying which one is this, Annas or Caiaphas. Well, in my study, I was reading, and I think it was, I don't remember which one it was, but someone says, in those days, it would not be uncommon for a house like this for the high priest to be quite large, actually, and to be kind of in a squarish shape, with, as we'll find out here in a minute, with an inner courtyard. So, you know, it's kind of this square shape, and then in the middle of it is a courtyard, and it's quite large. And it would have several entrances from the outside in to the home, and there's several entrances from the home into the inner square here. the courtyard. And this commentator was saying it's very possible and probably even probable that because Annas and Caiaphas were related, were part of the same family, that they could very possibly have both lived in the same house. And Caiaphas had his part of the house, and Annas had his part of the house. And so when you have them going from Annas to Caiaphas, it wasn't like walking across town. It was just walking across the courtyard from one side to the other. That's very possible that that's the way it was.
I read somewhere,
I'm pretty sure you have that reversed. I'm 99%. Annas is the oldest one. Well, because Annas, see, when Rome comes in, okay, they want to set up their own people. In other words, it's like, for example, if you work for the Cincinnati Reds, for example, and the team is sold to a new owner, the new owner comes in, and first thing they do, what they do, they clean house. Everybody loses their job, and they bring in their own people. So this is what the Romans did. They came in. Annas was the high priest of the Jewish people. They said, we're going to bring our own guy. And they brought in Caiaphas, who was related to Annas, but younger than Annas. But you're right. Caiaphas would have been the leader of the Sanhedrin at that time as the high priest. But the reason they took him to Annas is because this was a Jewish arrest made for Jewish theological purposes. And so they took him to the Jewish high priest first, who was Annas in their eyes. But Annas, he basically says, well, I'm not officially the guy. You got to go to Caiaphas too. And so that's why they went to both places. So, okay. So now here, but look at this. So how do we account for the fact that Matthew has Peter scattering and running away and fleeing, and Luke has him following at a distance? How can both of those be true? Is there a
scattering? I mean, where's the distance? He's scattered, basically.
But you think scattered would mean that he runs away and wants nothing to do eventually, but not here. Here, Luke wasn't there.
Got his information from Luke and got it.
Right. As a matter of fact, that's what David's sermon series is right now, right? Luke, we're looking at Jesus through other people's eyes because Luke, that's what Luke did. Because Luke didn't, he wasn't there, but he found out by hearing from other people. Right. Well, here's how it can happen logistically. Have you ever started in one direction and realized you're going the wrong way and you had to turn around? It never happens with Jan and I when we go, because I always know exactly where I'm going. And then I say, oh, we got to turn around. It's almost invariable. If Jan and I don't know where we're going, like a new place, we always miss it the first time. Like, yeah, right. And that's usually true. I go a long way before I realize, I'm willing to admit that I went and I'd done a turnaround. So that's what Peter did. He ran away, and he's running away, and then at some point, he realizes, now, wait a minute. What am I doing here? I want to find out what happens to Jesus. So he literally turns around and comes back and follows them at a distance. It's not hard to do. And how far could he have gotten? So he goes, he changes his mind, he turns around, and so they both are right. Matthew say he fled, he did flee, Luke is right. At this point, he's turned around and he's following at a distance. Okay. So verse 55. But when they had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat down with them. Now, this is a key point. I read this passage forever, my whole life, and I never really dealt critically and thought it through. Who is they? Verse 55. But when they had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and had sat down together, they sat down together. Peter sat down with them. Who are they? Right. No, you're right. I never really thought critically. If you go back to verse 52, it says, then Jesus said to who? The chief priests, the officers of the temple guard, and the elders who had come for him. These are the they. These are the they. These are the chief priests, the officers of the temple guard, and the elders who had come for him, and the other people who may have been a part of this party. They are the they who now have taken him to the chief priest, a high priest's home, and in the courtyard. And those are the they that have started the fire and sat down to warm themselves by it while Jesus is in being interrogated by Annas and Caiaphas. And so the they that are in the courtyard of the high priest's house, are they believers? I don't think so. I think any believers at this point, if the disciples had fled and scattered and fallen away, all of his believers had scattered and fallen away. I think at this point, all of these people, with the exception of Peter and John, we know John was there too. As a matter of fact, in John, John tells us that Peter couldn't get into the courtyard initially, and John was able to because John knew the lady who was guarding the gate because it was a friend of a friend. And so John is the one who went out and said to this woman, hey, let Peter come in too. So the whole reason Peter got in is because John was in. So John and Peter were there, but they were the only two, as far as we know, of the disciples. And probably everyone else in there were people who were opposed to Christ. So when it says Peter sat down among them, is this a good place for Peter to be? Right. Exactly. So does that give you, that gives me a new understanding of Peter's denial, because all of the people in that courtyard, all of the people around that fire were all against Christ. They were the very people that the disciples felt that they were in danger of, that Jesus was in danger of. They are the very people who could harm him, either, you know, if they arrested Jesus, they could arrest me too. And so, first of all, it took a lot of courage, I think, for Peter to even go in there with them and sit at that fire around them, but it was also probably a foolhardy thing to do. But when he is called out, to me, I understand a little bit better why Peter would have said, whoa, not me, because if he had admitted that he was one of Jesus' followers, what would he have expected that crowd to do? Yeah. So it's not just the fact that he was afraid because Jesus had been, he had an immediate threat on his life right there around that fire, because those are the people who were there. J. Vernon McGee says, Peter sat down with the wrong crowd. John was there too. Yeah, but we don't have John. John is there. We know he's there, but he's just kind of silent during this whole thing. After he gets Peter in there.
Nope.
Right. Peter was the one who was noticed.
Probably got way out of risk. I can't eat in the middle of the Los Angeles. I can't expect people to grow.
Well, I think, you know, let's ask ourselves, at this point, did Peter have a sudden recovery of his bravery? Or did he just think that, hey, it's dark, no one, I can kind of sneak in here and like no one will know? I don't know. I think it took a lot of courage to get there. But yes, we're going to get to that. Yep, yep, yep. Okay. As a matter of fact, one of the commentators, I think it was John MacArthur, said in his commentary, he said, and Peter, of course, couldn't keep his mouth shut. So, you know. But I think this is a lesson for us even today, and that is, do not put yourself in a compromising position as a Christian. I mean, there are certain places and certain people, and it's different for each of us, where you have a certain weak spot in your spirit, perhaps. And, you know, if you put yourself in a position, in a place, or with certain people, or whatever the influence is, you put yourself in a place where Satan can take advantage of you. So Peter is in a place where he probably shouldn't be, because he thought he could handle it, right? He's still in that position where I can still handle this. That probably is why he went in there, probably because I'm the guy who fell off his ear. I can do this. I can handle this. And he puts himself in a place among people where Satan can get him to compromise. And, you know, for some people, it might be certain movies you shouldn't be watching, certain TV shows you shouldn't be watching. Jan and I turn off TV shows all the time because it's like, nope, can't do that. Can't go there. And there are some shows where we get to the part, I'm like, I got to close my eyes. I can't watch it. So like, close my ears, you know. So you shouldn't see certain movies. You shouldn't see certain TV shows. You shouldn't read certain books or go to certain websites or look at certain magazines or, you know, maybe certain places you shouldn't go or certain people you shouldn't be around. Because when you do that, it's foolhardy. And why put yourself in a position where Satan can attack you and win a battle against you? Chuck? That's so true. Yeah, so I had in my old church, there was a guy, a sweet guy. And I started preaching on something along these lines. And he came up to me one time, and he goes, well, he goes, you know what? And he was a sweet guy, good Christian, really. And he said, a friend of mine, he works at a strip club. I've been going there, you know, but I guess I shouldn't. I said, yes, you're right. You should not. Don't go there anymore, because I'm not going to go there anymore. You know, so, yeah, you don't go there.
You talk about each younger thing than the other one. The rock music, all the false preaching that's going on. We've been thinking certain paths.
Yeah, right. You need to have a discern. You do have a discerning spirit as a Christian. You just have to tap into it, open yourself up to it. And if you're listening to a preacher or any ministry and you're not feeling this is right, then you need to get out of it. My daughter is involved with a small group of young millennials from her church, and she's trying to bring them into the truth of the gospel, and they just don't want to go. She's trying to kick them and bring them kicking and screaming, and they're resisting and resisting and resisting because they want to say, we're Jesus follower. See, I don't know that is being a Christian the same as being a Jesus follower. I'm not so sure, because what these guys want to do, they want to say we're Jesus followers, but they don't want to change a thing about their life. They don't want anything to change. It's okay because God's okay. Because no, but they don't want to hear it. They don't want. They want, as we talked so many times, they want Jesus to be the Jesus they want him to be. They want to be the people that Jesus wants them to be, and there's a big difference there. Okay, so let's go on, because I got to finish. Okay, so here we are. So verse 56 there. So these are the people that are around there. A servant girl saw him seated there in the firelight. She looked closely at him and said, this man was with him. Now, the word closely there in that verse, she looked closely at him. That's a very interesting word in the Greek, because it means to look intently. It means to lean forward. It means that she wanted to make sure that she recognized who this was. So this wasn't just like a knee-jerk reaction. Oh, I think I recognize. No, she looked closely. She looked intently. She leaned forward in the firelight. She wanted to make sure that she had it right. And she comes out and she goes, hey, people. Hey, folks. We have a fox in the hen house here. We got a fox in the hen house. And I just see her pointing at him. She goes, you know, this man was with him.
All the other things it said that is dressing.
So at this point, he hasn't said anything, apparently. But now he does, because look, he says, verse 57, but he denied it. Woman, I don't know him, he said. So there's something he says that they hear his accent. And so that's Peter's disowning number one. Okay, so let's go on to Peter's disowning number two. A little later, verse 58, someone else saw him and said, you also are one of them. And Peter says, man, I am not. Peter replied, disown number two. Peter's not doing too well here. And then verse 59, about an hour later, another asserted, certainly this fellow is with him, for he is a Galilean. Now, how did he know he was a Galilean? Because exactly what Grady said, we know in Matthew, we're going to look at that in just a minute. We know from Matthew that as the Galilean, they had a certain accent that you could recognize as, oh, you're from Galilee because you have that Galilean accent. Or maybe he was dressed in a certain way. The Galileans dress a certain way that are different. You know, they're fishermen or whatever. But something tipped it off, and probably it was his accent. I never will forget when we were going to, Jan's going to be so mad at me. When we were going to move over here, we lived in Indiana, and we're going to move over to Cincinnati. I worked for the Reds, and I said, let's get an apartment in Northern Kentucky, because it's close to the airport and it's close to the ballpark, and you know, it'll be real convenient for us to live there. She refused. She absolutely refused. We're going to live in Ohio. And I finally said, why is it so important to you that you don't live in, that we don't live in Kentucky, live in Ohio? She goes, because I don't want to start talking funny. Yeah, I am. She's from Indiana. I'm from West Virginia, but she's from Indiana. But I've always talked funny. But you know, you can tell someone, sometimes you can tell someone from Kentucky or Georgia, or because they have a Southern accent. Our son-in-law has relatives up in Northern Ohio, and they talk kind of like the Minnesotans. They're the Minnesotans, you know. So certain accents you can tell where someone is from by their accent. Okay, so let's go back now to Matthew, if you can take just a second. Matthew 26, because let's see what Matthew says, because he has Peter responding a little bit differently. So in Luke, then Peter said, man, I don't know what you're talking about. So that's Peter's disown number three. I don't know what you're talking about. Okay. So in Matthew 26, verse 69, Matthew 26, 69. It says, now Peter was sitting out in the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him. You also were with Jesus of Galilee. That must be the first one who looked him over so closely. But he denied it before them all. I don't know what you're talking about, he said. Then he went out to the gateway where another girl saw him. So he goes out to the gateway because he probably thinks, I'm too close to the fire. Too much light on my face here. So, and you know, he can't like run out. I'd like to see that. You know, he can't just run out to the gateway. Like this is a place, some kind of like a porch or something, like an overhang area. He can't like run out there like he's running away from something, because that would tip his hand that it really was. He really wasn't. So I can see Peter just going, just kind of strolling out, his hands behind him, just kind of leisurely walking out, but getting away from that fire as fast as, I mean, as slowly as he can, but getting out there so he doesn't draw attention to himself, because out there it's darker and more shadowy. So he goes out there, and another girl saw him and said to the people there, this fellow was with Jesus of Nazareth. So this is the second girl who saw him and asked him and accused him. He denied it again with an oath. I don't know the man. Now, Matthew gives us this, which Luke does not give us, with an oath. Basically, the idea there is he said something to the, in the Bible, when you do an oath, when someone takes an oath, you bring in God's name into it. So he would have said something like, I swear on the name of God, or something like that, as God is my witness, you know, something like that, some type of an oath where he's invoking God. As God is my witness, I don't know the man. Something along those lines.
Yep.
And that is what we feel. I love the way the chose for sure. One edits that and was tactful.
Yes. Took notes. Right. All those specifics. Yep. And so then at verse 73, after a little while, those standing there went up to Peter and said, "Surely you're one of them, for your accent gives you away." This is the third guy who said, "You're a Galilean. Your accent gives you away, the way you're talking there." Then, verse 74, Peter began to call down curses on himself and swore to them, "I don't know the man." Calling down curses on yourself. Now you're saying, this basically is saying, if I am lying to you, then may God strike me dead. It's actually calling down a curse on yourself is actually calling down the curse of death on yourself if what you're saying is not true. In the name of God. I mean, can you? I mean, it's bad enough to hear the way Luke describes it, but when you hear the way Matthew describes it, that not only did he disown Jesus, but he swore in God's name that if he knew him, then may God strike me dead right here, right now. I mean, that gets to be pretty bad, doesn't it? Reminds me of a story Lee Trevino tells. You know who Lee Trevino is, the golfer? So Lee Trevino says, he goes, "I learned my lesson." He said, "One time I was in a tournament. I was just burning it up. I was doing so great. I was in first place. We got in the back nine and we had a lightning warning," which, you know, when they have a lightning warning, you're supposed to immediately leave and leave the course because it's so dangerous. And, Lee Trevino says, he said, I pulled a 3-iron out of my bag of my golf clubs and I held it over my head like this. And I said, "I don't need to," he said, I'm safe now," holding the 3-wood. He says, "the 3-iron." He goes, "I'm safe now because even God can't hit a 3-iron." A couple years later, lightning warning, he goes, stands under a tree. Gets struck by lightning. True story. So don't fool around, right? I say, don't mess with Matt Dillon and Gunsmoke, but don't mess with God. Okay? So, okay, anyway. So that's what he was doing. So now let's go back to Luke. So we go back to Luke, verse 22:60. Peter replied, "Man, I don't know what you're talking about." Just as he was speaking. And the idea here in the Greek is almost as he was saying it, you know, it says just as he was speaking. I think Matthew says immediately. It was like barely had the words even gotten out of his mouth, then the rooster crows. And then this is something that Luke gives us that Matthew does not. He says, "The Lord turned and looked straight at Peter." So apparently, Peter's in this courtyard, right? And Jesus is being questioned at this point, probably by Caiaphas at this point. But Jesus is in somehow in a position in that home where he can turn and see the courtyard. Maybe it's a window, maybe it's a door, maybe it's an open porch, we don't know. But it's close enough that Peter can see Jesus and Jesus can see Peter. And so it says here, verse 61, "The Lord turned and looked straight at Peter." I find that just chilling. That gives me goosebumps. If it was a movie, can you imagine? If it was a movie, you'd have this long shot of Peter. And as soon as he said that and Jesus looked at him, that camera would like zoom right into Peter's face. And you would see this look on Peter's face. I mean, so Jesus turns and looks straight. And Luke makes it straight at him. And my question is, what kind of look was this, do you think? Was this a look of anger that Jesus was so upset at what Peter was doing? Or was it some other kind of look?
It was love. I had a lot of love. But this, for a lot of time, is one of has always benefited me in that. There's a thing in our situation that God's little creation is.
I think.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And I think Joe and I,
shame came into play because he suddenly realized what he has done after saying, there's nothing, I'm going to protect you. I'm going to give my life for you. I'm going to do everything I can to protect you. And then when you suddenly come to that point where what Jesus said and Jesus looked at you, oh my God. What have I done? You know, I'm guilty of what Jesus said I would do. How can I be forgiven? And then you run away and hide and isolate yourself. The psychology in there.
Yeah.
So amazing.
I think I told you before, when my kids would do, my son was the one who especially would do it, is, you know, he would do something like break something, you know, like. And he would always deny he did it, and but he obviously we knew he did it. But instead of like spanking him or making him stand in the corner or anything, the thing that always got my kids, that always got them the worst, is when I would look at them and I'd say, "I'm so disappointed in you." Oh, that just broke their hearts. You know, they don't want to disappoint dad or mom, and that was worse to them than getting a spanking. Was that, and so here, I think Jesus was like this. He looks at Peter with a love in his eye, but with a look of total disappointment. And that broke. I mean, Jesus could have hit him, struck him dead, struck him with lightning. Wouldn't have been as bad as seeing that look of disappointment on Jesus' face when Jesus looked at him. And so it says then that then Peter remembered the word the Lord had spoken to him. Before the rooster crows today, you will disown me three times. And my question is, why didn't Peter remember this before now? Why didn't he remember it after the first disownment or the second disownment? It not only took the third disownment, but it took Jesus looking at him and the rooster crowing before he actually kicked in.
Just like always before, he said, why didn't you hear? I've been telling you this.
Yeah.
Sit down. I'm not going to say me. It's an honor what I do and what I accomplish.
It's normal human behavior. You get yourself caught up in a really dangerous situation and you're grappling for how can I get myself out of this, and you're going to do everything possible to make it easier, and you get yourself so deep you can't get out of it.
Yeah, I think Jesus was probably dealing with a lot of. I have down here five things, for example. I think Peter was dealing with a lot here at this moment. I think he was stressed out. He's thinking, what's going to happen to Jesus? That's stressful. He was fearful. What's going to happen to me? He was confused. Why is this happening at all? And he was tired. I mean, when you get tired, right? You have a hard. I told you about my aunt in Finland who has dementia, pre-Alzheimer's. And all the time she says on her Marco Polo videos, I'm having trouble now because I'm just tired. You know, she does it at the end of the day. When you get tired and you're stressed and you're anxious and you're fearful and you're confused, or in Peter's case, maybe all of the above, then, you know, like Joe says, you got other things on your mind besides this. So that's what's happened. And then we're going to look at verse 62 really quick, because this is the aftermath. The aftermath. That's the act. That's the act of, and now the last thing, the aftermath, verse 62. And Matthew has something very similar to this in his passage. And he went outside and wept bitterly. So he runs out, he runs away. He's into the night, into the darkness. He's weeping bitterly. And in the Greek, the word that was used there, there's two words in Greek to use for crying. One indicates a soft, quiet kind of crying, but the other is a wailing and a loud crying. That's the kind of crying that, Mary had done at Jesus' crucifixion and so forth. But This is the kind of crying that Peter was doing, the wailing, the loud crying that is, you know, this is bitterly just out of control, loud wailing and crying uncontrollably and bitterly. So he leaves. So where do you think Peter went? You ever think about that? He left. He went outside and wept bitterly. Where did he go? Where do you think he might have gone?
Went outside.
The Bible doesn't tell us. The Bible doesn't tell us. We know that on the night of the resurrection, Peter's back in the upper room. But that's a few days later, right? That night, I mean, where would you have gone if you were Peter? But wouldn't you still kind of feel like you're in kind of a dangerous situation there? Garden of Gethsemane? Go back to the garden? Yeah, that's possible. That was a place where you were last closest to Jesus before it all started. But at that point, that's all behind him, though. You know, I'm not sure that he wanted to stay close. At that point, he might have been wanting to get as far away from Jesus as he could have, possibly. I think the Garden of Gethsemane is a good option because that was the last place he was with Jesus before this all started. He could have gone home. He could have gone back to Galilee because, hey, I'm getting out of town, man. I'm getting out of town. I'm out of Jerusalem. It's a distance, yeah. Yeah, it's not, yeah, it's not, it's, yeah, it's, he would have had taken some time to get there. But, you know, there he could have gone out on a boat. He could have gone to the shore of the Sea of Galilee, which were places that were familiar to him and safe spots to him. Or maybe he went to the Jordan River where Jesus had been baptized. Maybe went out in the wilderness where Jesus had gone so he could be kind of feeling that he was safe in a safe place. We don't know. The Bible doesn't tell us. But I just think it's interesting to wonder, where did he go for those next couple of days? And the next question, one of the last things we're going to look at here is, do you think Peter learned his lesson? Well, we happen to know the answer to that question. So if you want to turn over to 2 Peter, if you can find it in your Bible. I love 1 and 2 Peter. And the reason I love 1 and 2 Peter is because it is heavy theological stuff in 1 and 2 Peter. He deals with a lot of heavy theological issues. And you have to think, how did a fisherman, he's generally uneducated, he's a manual laborer, and yet he writes these wonderful things in 1 and 2 Peter. How is that possible? And the reason it's possible is because he learned, he went to the vocational school of being a disciple, right? Paul was the educated one. Peter was the vocational one, but they both end up being very, very smart. As a matter of fact, if you look in 2 Peter chapter 3, chapter 3, I'm going to just show you this on verse 7, show you how Peter and Paul kind of, Peter knew Paul, Paul's writing. So verse 15 of chapter 3, 2 Peter. Bear in mind, Peter says, that our Lord's patience means salvation. Just as our dear brother Paul also wrote you with wisdom that God gave him, he writes the same way in all his letters, speaking in them of these matters. His letters contain some things that are hard to understand, which ignorant, unstable people distort, as they do other scriptures, to their own destruction. So Peter's saying, Paul is right on. I think that's really interesting that he knew Paul's writing, and says, Paul is okay with me. Okay, then verse 17. Therefore, dear friends, since you already know this, be on your guard so that you may not be carried away by the error of lawless men and fall from your, what do you have there next in your secure position? Steadfastness, stability. So isn't it interesting that after he went through this, three disownments, three denials of Jesus, what he's saying at the very end of his last letter to the people who are reading it, you know, when you get to the end of your of a letter, you want to make sure that, or a sermon or a lesson, you make sure that you get the most important thing in. And he says, at the very end, don't fall from your secure position, your steadfastness, your stability. Why? Because that's exactly what I did. So when you go through something and you fail Jesus and you come back and you realize and you're sad about it and you ask forgiveness and he forgives you, then that puts you in a unique position to say to other people, don't do what I did. That's what Peter is saying here. Don't do what I did. So he did learn his lesson. Okay, last thing, and then we're going to do our prayers. Thank you. I think we got through it all. Okay, this is William Barclay, and he, I just love this. It's so articulate. And so this is William Barclay, where he kind of puts a bow on the package that's Peter's denial. He says, about Peter, he was torn between two feelings. In his heart, there was a fear that made him want to run away. But in his heart, too, there was a love which kept him there. Again, in the porch, he was recognized, and this time he swore he did not know Jesus. And still he did not go. Here is the most dogged courage. But Peter's second denial had given him away. From his speech, it was clear that he was a Galilean. The Galilean spoke with a burr. So ugly was their accent that no Galilean was allowed to pronounce the benediction at a synagogue service. Didn't know that, did you? Once again, Peter was accused of being a follower of Jesus. Peter went further this time. Not only did he swear that he did not know Jesus, but he actually cursed his master's name. But still, it was clear that Peter had no intention of leaving that courtyard. And then the cock crew. I think the cock crowed. Anyway. He was English. So maybe that's how they say it in England. There is a distinct possibility. Now, this, I've never heard this before. This is kind of interesting. But I'm going to say, let me first say, preface this. Barclay always tries to find a way of explaining Jesus' miracles without making them seem so miraculous. So Barclay, you have to take everything Barclay says with a grain of salt when it comes to the miracles and things, because he always tries to explain them away. Not that they weren't miracles, but that there were more reasonable explanations as to why they might have happened or how they happened. Okay, so that said, he says, there is a distinct possibility here which would provide us with a vivid picture. It may well be that the cock crow was not the voice of a bird, and that from the beginning it was not meant to mean that. After all, the house of the high priest was right in the center of Jerusalem, and it is unlikely that there would have been poultry in the center of the city. There was, in fact, a regulation in the Jewish law that it was illegal to keep cocks and hens in the holy city because they defiled the holy thing. But the hour of 3 a.m., was called cock crow, and for this reason, at that hour, the Roman guard was changed at the castle of Antonia, and the sign of the changing of the guard was a trumpet call. The Latin for that trumpet call is Gallicidium, which means cock crow. It is at least possible that just as Peter made his third denial, the trumpet from the castle battlements rang out over the sleeping city. The Galicinia, the cock crow. And Peter remembered, and thereupon he went and wept his heart out. What happened to Peter after that, we do not know, for the gospel story draws a kindly veil over the agony of his shame. But before we condemn him, we must remember very clearly that few of us would ever have had the courage to be in that courtyard at all. And there is one last thing to be said. It was love which gave Peter that courage. It was love which riveted him there in spite of the fact that he had been recognized three times. It was love which made him remember the words of Jesus. It was love which sent him out into the night to weep. And it is love which covers a multitude of sins. The lasting impression of this whole story is not of Peter's cowardice, but of Peter's love. Good conclusion, isn't it? So, okay. That concludes this episode of Where's God?
finding him in the Small Stuff Bible Study. I pray that you've learned something new about the Lord today, and he's given you some new insight into who he is and how much he loves you. Remember, the eternal God is our refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms. May in that refuge today and those everlasting arms, you find the provision that you need, the protection that you need, the power that you need, and through those, the peace that you need. Remember, he said, "My peace I give you, peace be with you. Shalom."